In John chapter 4, we see one of the most fascinating encounters in the life of Jesus and the Gospels. And it's just this interaction with the woman of Samaria. Incredible and amazing what happens here. So as we go through this, you know, we'll go as far as we can get. I don't know how far that will be. So if we have to stop before we get to the end of her encounter with Jesus, then we may lose some continuity. But I want to give it full rift and not shortchange anything that might be here that we will benefit from. So I have some lengthy notes, but it may go faster than I think it will. But we saw as Jesus was baptizing in the end of chapter 3 and into chapter 4 that his disciples were baptizing, it tells us in verse 2 here. Jesus himself didn't do the baptizing. But he was beginning to baptize and make more disciples than John the Baptist. And so when he knew that the Pharisees had heard this, then he decided to leave Judea and depart again to Galilee. He was more on their radar. It was going to become more of an encounter between him and them. And it wasn't time for that yet. He wasn't ready for that situation to take place. And we're going to see through the Gospel of John, and you can see it in the other Gospels as well, this escalating conflict between Jesus and the religious leaders of Judaism, which of course culminates in the crucifixion, the betrayal, crucifixion of Jesus. But here tells us in verse 4 that he needed to go through Samaria. So we know that many Jews, the really righteous ones, that is the self-righteous ones, they avoided going through Samaria. And they went east of the Jordan through an area called Perea. It's much further of a journey. Or some of them would go over to the coast and go up the coast, once again increasing the journey by some distance, because they didn't want to go through this area where the Samaritans were. And we'll see more about, you know, this conflict between them as we go along as well. But so they go way out of their way to get from Judea to Galilee, or from Galilee to Judea normally. And if God required this, it would be commendable to go out of your way to obey God. But since he did not require it, it was not commendable to do that. And so it says Jesus needed to go through Samaria. The King James says he must needs to go through Samaria. And so we see that word must in there. And we're seeing must several times in chapter 3 and again here in chapter 4. And this is the same word that's used when Jesus in chapter 3 told Nicodemus, you must be born again. That's the same word here that New King James translates it, needed. Or the Son of Man must be lifted up. Or he must increase and I must decrease. Same word. And so we're seeing that he must go through Samaria. There's no particular reason why he had to go that way. He could have gone any other route. But we know that he has a divine appointment with someone. And there are some commentators that will say, you know, when he comes to the woman at the well, they say, well, it was a happenstance. You know, he happened to be there, the woman happened to be there. And so this took place, you know. But I think the Lord knew that he was going to meet this person, and he knew their needs, and so he was prepared for this encounter. So in verse 5, it says, he came to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. So when Jacob was in the land, he purchased a plot of land. In Genesis 33:19, it says, he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And this Sychar was called Shechem in previous generations. And so it's either the Shechem that Jacob talked about, it's very nearby and sort of took over that area. Then in Genesis 44:22, Jacob telling Joseph, moreover, I've given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. And then in Joshua 24:32, when the Israelites had come into the land, it says, the bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of Egypt, they buried at Shechem in the plot of ground, which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance in the children of Joseph. So we see this is that area that's being talked about. When Jesus comes to this city, Sukkar, he's coming to the plot of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. And it says Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied from his journey, sat thus by the well, and it was about the sixth hour. The site of this well has been associated with Jacob for millennia. Jewish, Samaritan, Muslim, and Christian traditions all identify this well as the one that Jacob excavated. And you can go there today and see this well. It was deep, originally about, I've seen estimates of 100 to 135 feet deep, and it's partially through hewn limestone rock to get to the get the well dug. Now it's partially filled with debris, and so it's only about 70, 75 feet deep and mostly dry. When the storms come, the rainy season, then there will be some water in it, but otherwise the level's too low. A church was built over it, and a monastery now occupies the site. So there's a building over this, the site of this well. Today it's located in the West Bank, as they call it, Judea, Samaria. And it's a Samaritan town of Nablus, is what it's called today, controlled by the Palestinian Authority. So Jesus is wearied from his journey, it tells us, when he comes here. They've been walking through the day. He could have drawn on his limitless resources as the Son of God, but he lived among us as a real man with genuine humanity. Actually, he's the most human man who ever lived, with true humanity. He suffered the things that we suffer in the body. He got tired. He got thirsty. He got hungry, etc. He had to be one of us to be a valid substitute for us in taking on our iniquities. Goats and sheep would not do except as examples and foreshadowings. And so Jesus comes, he's tired, just like you would be tired if you hike up Mount Lakat. Sixth hour, it depends on whether Jewish or Roman time is being spoken of here. There are, reputable commentators come down on both sides, and they all have their reasons and their support. If it's Jewish time, it's 12 noon. And that would explain somewhat this woman being there isolated. If it's Roman time, it's 6 p.m. And many of the time estimates that John gives us concerning crucifixion time fit much better with the other Gospels on Roman time. But, he doesn't tell us. John tells us, explains all these things. When he uses a Hebrew term, he'll say, by the way, that's this, because he's speaking to the Romans or the Greeks. But he doesn't tell us here which time frame he's speaking about. But there is a social activity that goes on around wells of water in this day. The women would go out at certain times, and they would tend to go out together to get water. And so they had this social interaction and activity as they would go out. Now, instead of water wells, we have water closets. And the women go there, and have the social activity together. But back then it was water wells. And they would go out to get the water for the day. And, that's a task. We're not accustomed to that in any sense of the word. We're used to going in, whatever room it is, and turning on the tap, and here comes the water. But they didn't have that. They had to go out, get water out of the well, carry it back to their dwelling place, and use it. But the women would tend to do this together. This woman doesn't. And that tells us something about her social relations with the other women. So Jesus is tired. He could take a break. He could go over, rest in the shade, lay down for a little while. Well, we see the disciples have gone away to buy food. He could avoid interaction with others. Who could blame him? crowds pressing around him all the time, wanting something, you know. Especially with the social norms of the day, because this encounter he's going to have is not in keeping with the social norms. It could be bordering on the scandalous to others. Jesus did not care much for keeping social norms. He came to seek and save that which is lost. Social norms be darned, in lieu of using that other word. Now, if we ignore a social norm, we need to be certain it's for a righteous purpose and not merely for our own desires. There was no question of this with Jesus. We might break a social norm just for the heck of it, to avoid using that other word. People are often offended when social norms are broken, even if no sin is involved. But we should not go out of our way to break a social norm just to be sensational, to show our superiority to such things. Oh, you know, that's not important. I know better. We all have knowledge, right? Paul says that concerning the spiritual gifts. We all have knowledge, but knowledge puffs up. Love edifies. But as with all other situations, he came to this encounter with a purpose. Rather than concentrate on his own needs, I'm tired, thirsty, I'm hungry, he once again lays those needs aside for the greater need of another. The need for her thirst to be quenched is greater than the need for his thirst to be quenched, or even for his hunger to be satisfied. So we're told a woman of Samaria, we never get her name. According to tradition, she has a name, and you know they know who it is, but I don't always trust those names they assign, so I didn't look it up. I mean, I saw it, but didn't note it. A woman of Samaria came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." You would think, well, at least he could say, "Please give me a drink." You know, she's coming out to get water by herself. He and she are the only ones there. And he says, "Give me a drink." This is unusual. It is a social norm that Jesus is breaking or overstepping. We see later the disciples are flabbergasted when they come back. The text says they marveled that he was talking with a woman. It was not the norm and could even be viewed as scandalous. And with such a woman who would not be considered virtuous. Jewish teachers warned against talking much with women in general. They would have especially avoided Samaritan women, who they declared were unclean from birth. By tradition, a rabbi would not speak with a woman in public. These are the really strict rabbis. Not even his own wife. Other ancient accounts show that even asking water of a woman could be interpreted as flirting with her. And this woman might naturally think so. You remember in Luke chapter 7 when Jesus went to the house of Simon the Pharisee and he prepared a meal for him and they were eating and all, and the woman comes in. And she starts washing his feet with her tears and drying them with her hair and so forth. And Simon's thinking, man, if he knew what kind of woman she was, if he was really a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman she was and he wouldn't let this go on. But, you know, Simon was mistaken. Jesus did know what kind of woman she was. Jesus knows what kind of women all women are. And he knows what kind of men all men are. And he sees their needs and desires to meet those needs if only they would come to him. So Jesus says, "Give me a drink." He starts with common ground. We can learn a lot of things about witnessing encounters here as well. He starts with common ground, something non-controversial, water. They're both interested in water at this point. But give me a drink. They're both thirsty. The woman doesn't know that Jesus is going to address her spiritual thirst. And his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food, so he couldn't ask them for a drink. Right? There was that one part of the plan. It was just him and this woman. And the woman of Samaria said to him, "How is it that you, being a Jew, ask a drink from me, a Samaritan woman?" And she may have said it like that. You know, we don't get the vocal inflections and stuff that are going on here. "For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans." And we don't know if that's part of what she said or if that's John's commentary, but either way, it's true. She could tell he was a Jew by his appearance. She didn't have to ask. The hem of his garment would be a different color than the hem of a Samaritan's garment. They had different religious traditions that went on. And here we see the animosity that existed between the Jews and the Samaritans. And it has its roots deep in the history of Israel. Barnes says, the Samaritans occupied the country formerly belonging to the tribe of Ephraim and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Now you remember, the kingdom was united under David and Solomon, and then under Rehoboam, Solomon's son, the kingdom was divided. And you had the northern kingdom, which was Israel, and you had the southern kingdom, which was Judah. And Samaria is within that northern kingdom of Israel. So the people in this land were formerly composed of a few of the 10 tribes and a mixture of foreigners. And when the 10 tribes were carried away into captivity to Babylon, the king of Assyria sent people from Cutha, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim to inhabit their country. So they were exported to Babylon, and they would tend to do this, these conquering nations. They would take people from the land. They'd take the ones they wanted. They might leave the poor and destitute there, but they would take the nobles and so forth. And then they would take people from other lands and put them there. And so this disorients their rebelliousness, you know, because they're no longer comfortable. They're in an odd place. They're in a different culture. And so they would mix these people up, and they did this with Samaria. These people at first worshipped the idols of their own nations, but being troubled with lions, which had increased greatly while the country remained uninhabited, they supposed it was because they had not honored the God of the country. And you'll find this in 2 Kings chapter 17. It tells us there in verse 26, they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations whom you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and indeed they are killing them because they do not know the rituals of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, send there one of the priests whom you brought from there. Let him go and dwell there, and let him teach them the rituals of the God of the land. They had all these different gods, and they believed it was important wherever you were to, you know, keep the rituals of the God of that land. God doesn't say this, you know, he's not concerned with rituals. Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. So you ended up with a real mixture of Judaism and idolatry, and well, we'll see more about their practices as we go along. So a Jewish priest was sent to them from Babylon to instruct them in the Jewish religion. They were instructed partially from the books of Moses, but still retained many of their old rites and idolatrous customs, and embraced a religion made up of Judaism and idolatry. And so the grounds of difference between the two nations were this. The Jews, after their return from Babylon, set about rebuilding their temple. The Samaritans offered to aid them. You'll find this in Nehemiah, Ezra. The Jews, however, perceiving that it was not from a love of true religion, but that they might obtain a part of the favors granted to the Jews by Cyrus, rejected their offer. The consequence was that a state of long and bitter animosity arose between them and the Jews. There were other reasons, and we see some of those as well. While Nehemiah was engaged in building the walls of Jerusalem, the Samaritans used every art to thwart him in his undertaking. You remember, at one point, Nehemiah and his men were working with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other, you know, because there this opposition that was taking place. And one of the people of the land there tried to entice Nehemiah into going and spending the night in the temple so they could sneak in and attack him and kill him. You know, it was like, you'll be safe in there. And Nehemiah's like, hey, am I a man that I should be afraid and hide? You know, so he realized that something was going on. The Samaritans at length obtained leave of the Persian monarch to build a temple for themselves. This was erected on Mount Gerizim, and they strenuously contended that this was the place designated by Moses as the place where the nation should worship. We'll see this in the woman's conversation. Sanballat, the leader of the Samaritans, constituted his son-in-law, Manasseh, high priest. The religion of the Samaritans thus became perpetuated, and an irreconcilable hatred arose between them and the Jews. Afterwards, Samaria became a place of resort for all the outlaws of Judea. It was a sanctuary country. They received willingly all the Jewish criminals and refugees from justice, the violators of the Jewish laws, and those who had been excommunicated, betook themselves for safety to Samaria and greatly increased their numbers and the hatred which subsisted between the two nations. The Samaritans received only the five books of Moses, the Pentateuch. They rejected the writings of the prophets and all the Jewish traditions. And from these causes rose an irreconcilable difference between them, so that the Jews regarded them as the worst of the human race and had no dealings with them. So they only accepted the Pentateuch, first five books of Moses, as being valid scripture. And then they changed some of that to fit in with what they were doing in Samaria, and particularly Mount Gerizim. Alfred Adersheim talks about some of the things that this region went through as a nation or people, you know, during various times. And it says they suffered more than any other parts of the country after the death of Alexander. In 320 BC, it passed from the rule of Syria to that of Egypt. 6 years later, it again became Syrian. Only 3 years afterwards, Ptolemy reconquered and held it for a short time. And on his retreat, he destroyed the walls of Samaria and of other towns. In 301, it passed again by treaty into the hands of Ptolemy. Out in 298, it was once more ravaged by the son of Antigonus. After that, it enjoyed a season of quiet under Egyptian rule till the reign of Antiochus the Great, when it again passed temporarily and under his successor, Seleucus, permanently under Syrian domination. So in about 20-25 years, this country is switching, you know, rulership, this region. In the troublous times of Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes, you remember him? He's the one who desecrated the temple and sacrificed a pig upon the altar, declared himself to be God, Jupiter actually, and Epiphanes, the appearance. So he was Antiochus the Fourth, but he became Epiphanes, I'm the appearance. And so under his rule, the Samaritans escaped the fate of the Jews by repudiating all connection with Israel and dedicating their temple to Jupiter. So here they got this temple where they're, you know, worshiping Yahweh, but when Antiochus comes through, they're like, oh, we're going to dedicate this to Jupiter now, you know, to escape being attacked or killed. In the contest between Syria and the Maccabees, which followed, the Samaritans, as might be expected, took the part of the former. So they opposed the Maccabees. And in 130 BC, John Hyrcanus destroyed the temple on Mount Gerizim, which was never rebuilt. So a lot of animosity between the two peoples here. And their temple destroyed by one of the Maccabees or descendants. So when Jesus sent out his disciples in Matthew chapter 10, he told them, do not go in the way of the Gentiles and do not enter a city of the Samaritans. Now that could be taken the wrong way, that Jesus didn't like Gentiles and Samaritans. We know that's not the case. But, you know, it kind of would fit in with what the Jews were thinking. This was not because he didn't care for the Gentiles or the Samaritans. It was first to the Jew, then to the Greek. The Samaritans are reached here in chapter 4 by Jesus himself. And in Acts 8 by the apostles, and then the Gentiles are reached in Acts 10. Jesus was cursed by the Pharisees in John 8, chapter 8, verse 48. The Jews tell him, do we not say rightly that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Not only was he bad enough to be a Samaritan, but he was a demonic, possessed Samaritan. You're worse than a Samaritan. And so a Samaritan to them was a heretic, a false teacher, one who leads people astray. And they said he was worse than that. So this is the contempt with which Samaritans were held by the Jews, and the feeling was not one-sided, it was mutual. Luke chapter 10, Jesus tells a parable. The guy asks him the greatest commandment. He says, love, you know, one of them is love your neighbor as yourself. And says the guy wanted to justify himself. And so he asked, who's my neighbor then? Seeking to justify himself. And you remember the story that Jesus told? How do we title that story in our Bibles? The Good Samaritan. Like there's only one, you know. The only good Indian, you know. The Good Samaritan. That's the way we title it. There's in your life, there's only one of them. I call it the incident at Jericho. But Jesus makes the Samaritan the hero of the story. Imagine the reaction of the people who were listening to him when he's telling this story. And the priest and the Levite, the best of the Jews, they were the bad guys. This must have created some ire among the religious leaders. So when Jesus talks with this woman here, he's not saying that truth is not important. He addresses that with her. But compassion is not sectarian. It's not who is my neighbor, but to whom will I be a neighbor? Who will I love as myself? In Luke chapter 17, one more incident with Samaritan is that there Jesus cleanses 10 lepers. And he tells them to go to the temple, present the sacrifice, testify to the priests. And they all take off, and one guy comes back to give thanks, and he falls down at Jesus' feet. And that one guy was a Samaritan. And he says, is only this foreigner came back to give thanks to God? It's Luke chapter 17. So she's, you know, rightly questions, says, oh, you're a Jew. Why are you asking a drink from me, a Samaritan woman? And Jesus answers and says to her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is who says to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. You're the one who needs a drink of the water I can give you. Now, living water was simply a spring or flowing water. You have well water, which was just, you know, it might have been a cistern, you know, just water already dug down the ground, so it's still water. Living water in the common vernacular was flowing water, unlike the well of Jacob. But Jesus, of course, uses it in quite a different connotation. Once we get over to chapter 7, we'll see that he's talking about, he says living water representative of the Holy Spirit. And so he says here, if you knew who it was that's talking to you, and the gift of God, you'd say, hey, I need the water that you can give. And the woman says to him, Jesus is talking spiritual now, she's still on the material. She says to him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well's deep. Where then do you get that living water? So she doesn't respond with, who is it who says to me? She doesn't immediately ask the obvious question that should have arisen in her mind. Instead, she immediately questions his ability to do what he says. You don't have anything to draw with. The well's deep, and there's no living water in there anyway. So where are you going to get? Do you know about a spring around here that I don't know about? The fact that there's nothing to draw water with probably indicates this was not the community water source, since there would be a winch, a rope, etc. for drawing water. This is probably one reason the woman is here alone, even if it is 6 p.m., because there was a well much closer to the city environs of Sychar, and that is probably the community well, and that's probably where the other women went, and so she comes out here to avoid. She wasn't popular with the other women, is the connotation. We don't get the inflections of speech or the attitudes conveyed by the woman's speech. So the tenor of this conversation is somewhat open to interpretation. People interpret it in different ways. And I think we can look at it in different ways and people can glean different things from it. You know. But some take it as a straightforward conversation on the woman's part. It certainly is on Jesus' part. I think the woman probably thinks that this conversation is flirtatious up to a certain point. She's used to men reacting to her in this way, and her responses can be taken in this light. So she's like, you know, going back and forth with this flirtatious conversation. That's not Jesus's intent at all. On the surface, his words here could not mean anything serious to her. What's he saying? If you knew who said, give me a drink, you'd have asked him, he would have given you living water. I mean, he doesn't have anything with him to even get water with. What could this mean? He's flirting with me, you know. She calls him sir here. She hasn't said this before. Sir is the word kurios in the Greek. It's used 747 times in the New Testament, and it's normally translated Lord or Master. 11 times it's translated sir. And so here it's translated as sir. You know, it could be translated as Lord or Master, but probably with their relationship and the way she's responding, sir is probably a good translation. How are you going to get this water? And she says, are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank from it himself, as well as his sons and his livestock? Now she returns to the question of who he is. He can't be greater than Jacob. And this Jacob is a little bit of a jab too. You know, he's our father Jacob. We're descendants of Jacob. Actually, they were a mixed race because these people that came back, they intermarried. This is one of the problems the Jews had with the Samaritans. They were half-breeds, half-Jews, half-Samaritans. So there's a certain amount of superiority in her speech. Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well? And he drank it. You know, this is actually where he drank from. And Jesus answered her and said, whoever drinks of this water will thirst again. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. But the water that I shall give him will become in him a fountain of water springing up into everlasting life. A drink from which you will never thirst again. This is not your ordinary Aquafina. It's not spring water, it's not tap water, it's not infused water, it's not alkaline water, it's not structured water, it's not rainwater or well water, it's not physical water. It's not physical, it doesn't quench a physical thirst. You can get this water, you can still, you know, die of parched lips because it's not going to quench your physical thirst. It quenches a thirst of the soul. And one can truly say that they thirst again no more in the same way if they've drunk of this living water. One knows the truth. The meaning of life is known. The questions of who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? Are answered and put to rest. Now it's a matter of getting to know the one who is the answer. To know him better and better. It doesn't mean you have no longing or desire remaining, but it's not the same. You know the source and the meaning of life, and that seeking is over. I'm not a big fan of Augustine and some of his theological conclusions, but I do agree with a statement he made, Augustine of Hippo. He said, thou hast made us for thyself, O Lord, and our heart is restless until it finds its rest in thee. We are thirsty souls looking for something to fill that, to quench that thirst, to fill our hearts because they're empty. Men and women are empty without God. There's a longing and a thirst in their hearts. We're born dead in trespasses and sins, but we know there has to be more to life than what we have. And so we set about trying to find out what that more is. And we may try all sorts of different things to try and fill that empty place. There has to be meaning and purpose, but there's also the blindness or deceitfulness of sin. So there's an attempt to fill this emptiness or satisfy this thirst with anything other than God. Proverbs 14 We haven't come to this yet Thursday night. We just finished 13. But there's a proverb in 14:14 that says, "The backslider in heart will be filled with his own ways, but a good man will be satisfied from above." And it's not just the backslider, the person that doesn't know the Lord. They're filled with their own ways. This is what we seek to fill that empty place with. A good man, that is, a man that knows the Lord, he'll be satisfied from above. So you're either filled with yourself or you're filled with God. A person without God seeks to fill the void in their own ways. The specifics differ for different people. It may be money, could be drink or drugs, could be sports or fitness, could be sex, could be ruling over others, philosophy, music, theology, hobbies, religion, etc. Even atheism, to seek to fill that void. Remember Jesus when he said that if the light is in you, be darkness, how great is the darkness? Well, it's true that if the fullness that is in you is emptiness, how great is the emptiness? You know the works of the flesh. The things we seek to fill ourselves with may be innocuous for the most part. Nothing sinful about them. They may be things that are not condemned in the Bible, but they will not satisfy in the end. We're truly fortunate when we run out of things that we seek to satisfy ourselves with, because it leaves the option, the remaining option, that is a genuine one. They won't slake the thirst for God. This woman's been trying to fill her heart with relationships, going from man to man as the relationships fail and did not satisfy. The thirst for the true water of life continues. In Psalm 63, we see some of this thirst of man, and this is with us who know the Lord. You know, this is David, Psalm 63. He says, "O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. Because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips shall praise you." So the psalmist thirsts, but it's not a thirst for ultimate meaning. He knows that. He's thirsting for a deeper relationship with the Lord, that he might know the Lord greater. The quest does not end. It changes. Psalm 42 says, "As the deer pants for the water brook, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they continually say to me, 'Where is your God?'" And then in the Beatitudes, Matthew 5, verse 6, Jesus says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." These are souls that are awakened to their need for God and have become willing to part from their own ways with which they have been seeking to fill themselves and to drink from his fountain that will never run dry. Once you've drunk from this fountain, it's a continually flowing stream that springs up into everlasting life. Make no mistake, God is always calling out, like Isaiah says in Isaiah 55, "Ho, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come buy and eat. Yes, come buy wine and milk without money and without price." So he calls people who are thirsty, "Come and drink. It's free. It doesn't cost anything. You have to give up your own ways. That might be costly for some, but it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to somehow come up with a certain amount of treasure." So just as Jesus has come to this woman to let her know the true way to slake her thirst, God calls to every man or woman who lives. God will stir up a hunger and thirst in men's hearts that they might seek him if he should be found. Remember in Acts chapter 17 when Paul is speaking to the Athenians. He tells them that he made from every nation one blood. He made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings so that they should seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each of us. There is that hunger and that thirst that we might seek the Lord. And everyone who seeks finds. Jesus tells us that. God speaks to hearts. Some hear and respond. When E.F. Hutton speaks, people may listen. When God speaks, not everyone listens. Jesus said, Matthew 11:15, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. That's one of eight times that Jesus says that in the Gospels. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. So here's the offer. Living water, become a fountain in you, springing up into everlasting life. That's the offer. It's never been rescinded. It's never failed to deliver. You never thirst. The quest is over. Long live the quest. The quest to find true meaning, the meaning of life, to find God, is ended with the living water. But the quest to know God, that goes on. Long live the quest. And the woman says, sir, give me this water that I may not thirst nor come here to draw. And the woman may be thinking at this point, wow, this sounds like an infomercial. And maybe she probably wouldn't know what an infomercial is, right? But too good to be true. What this guy say, what this Jewish guy is saying, I mean, what's he talking about? So she says, give me this water, because, I don't want to thirst. So she's still thinking on the material plane. It may seem that way to many, but if you take the Lord up on his offer, you'll find that it's true. It's not an empty promise of an infomercial. I think there's still a little bit of flirtatious mocking in this response. He's, like a mocking, oh, yeah, give me this water. You don't have anything to give me water with. Give me this water so I don't thirst and don't come here to draw. Jesus is speaking spiritually. She's thinking materially. And then Jesus says to her, go call your husband and come here. Uh-oh. The tenor of the conversation has changed with this one statement. I just want to share the living water with you and your husband. So, be better if you're here as a couple. We can go on the 3-hour tour of the condominiums. Go call your husband and come here. Jesus needs to do a little more spiritual surgery in this situation. How can she know that this is really real? That the man can make good on his offer? Jesus can't give her living water apart from faith in him. So she needs to understand who he is so that she can believe in him. And she needs to know how the living water can address her own need. So Jesus just sounds innocent, doesn't it? Go call your husband. Come here. And the woman answers, I have no husband. She answers honestly, but incompletely. If she does think Jesus is flirting with her, this answer may mean, I'm available. I don't have a husband. But I think she's getting more of the serious tone of the conversation at this point. And Jesus says to her, you have well said, I have no husband. You told me truly. But then he says, for you have had 5 husbands. And the one whom you now have is not your husband. In that, you spoke truly. J. Vernon McGee says one of the reasons she was not so popular with the women of the town was because she was too popular with the men of the town. Jesus indicates the futility of her thirst-quenching strategy. He points out the failure in her life and the sinfulness of her life. He doesn't say this cruelly. He says it to reveal that he knows of her pain and her need. When we encounter sinners, it must not be in a spirit of condemnation, but in a spirit of compassion. We are not better than them. We are better off than them. But that, not by our own merits. She's been looking for something lasting in these relationships, and she has not found it. Now, many make the mistake of expecting their spouse or other human relationship to provide ultimate fulfillment in their life. This is an unrealistic, even impossible expectation. There's only one who can fulfill this role. To expect from a human being something that only God can provide is futile. Human relationships can provide many blessings, as God has created it to be so. But they cannot provide this ultimate meaning or purpose in life, and to expect or demand this puts unnecessary stress on a relationship. It's called looking for love in all the wrong places. There's only one place where unfailing love is to be found. There was a pastor years ago that I read about, and once a year he would preach a sermon on, "I'll let you down, I will fail you." And it's true, because no human being is going to be without, is going to be perfect, is going to carry out every activity in the way that they should. Terry Taylor wrote a song and expressed it as, "I'll burst your bubble." You might think I'm going to be this person, you know, up here, this standard all the time, but I'm weak and I fail, and you know, I'll burst your bubble. I will fail you. But this is not an excuse for a lack of commitment in a relationship. One side of it that's erroneous is expecting this person to be everything to me that only God can be. And the other side of it that's erroneous is saying to this spouse or other person, well, I can't be what you want me to be, so I'm not going to carry out any of my responsibilities toward you. I'm just going to, you know, ignore you or, you know, let you take care of yourself. Just leave me alone. So you got a problem, you know, you can have a problem both ways. He or she's expecting too much of me can be an excuse for a lack of love or commitment. We do carry those responsibilities in any human relationship, and especially in a marriage relationship. But only God can fill this thirst completely and entirely. So Jesus says, go call your husband. She says, oh, he says, you've had five husbands. And the woman says, sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. This is, I mean, she has no other explanation, but this is, it's not a great response, you know. It's just because she's, Jesus has revealed something. He's laid everything of her life out in front of her. And she sort of stopped cold here. Oh, I think you're a prophet. Just what you said, you know, just what you just said. I think you could be a prophet. And so she seeks to change the subject. And she brings up a religious question. Now, when you're witnessing to people and things get uncomfortable, a lot of times you'll find that they seek to change the topic to something else. And this is something that is good to avoid. You don't want to get off on something and, you know, you can get in this big theological argument and all these things when the Lord's really wanting to minister to their need and point out their need. So we'll see how Jesus handles this. He deals with it, but then he comes right back to the issue. And that's what we need to do. But her question is, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and Mount Gerizim here is, it's right there where everybody can see it. You know, from where they're at, she and Jesus can see this mountain where the Samaritans worship. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where one ought to worship. For the woman, this is uncomfortable. It's time to change the subject. What Jesus is saying cuts too close to the bone. He's laying bare things that are better kept covered from her perspective. And so let's have a religious discussion. I'll bring up something that's controversial that, you know, he will have difficulty answering, and we'll get away from this. We'll get off this topic. And so Jesus says to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." That's the other must in our chapter, chapter 4, must worship him in spirit and in truth. So Jesus answers her question, but he does not allow her to change the topic or deflect the truth that he's giving her. Worship is not location, location, location. God established his presence in Jerusalem in a particular way for the carrying out of sacrifices that foreshadowed the coming of the Messiah as a substitutionary sacrifice. But he was never limited to that location, and most men and women, where they were, he was not limited to that location and met men and women where they were when they sought his face. So he met them in all sorts of different places. That was the place he designated for sacrifice, but he wasn't limited to there. Today, there's no need to go from place to place to chase the anointing. There was a book years ago, it was called The God Chasers. This was about people who would go to where the anointing was, you know, which is usually a hyper-charismatic kind of a situation. They would go here, and then the anointing would move, you know, over here, and then they'd have to go to this city and spend some time there, and then they'd go up here, and, you know. So they were the God chasers. You don't need to chase the anointing. God is where you are. You need to seek him where you are. Because it's not location, location, location. He's not limited to a certain location. Seek him where you are, and he'll be found of you. But Jesus says here, the foreshadowing is over. The reality has come. The day is coming. The hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will men worship the Father, because Jerusalem was going to be obliterated. The temple was going to be destroyed. He doesn't avoid, you know, telling her the truth, because he says, you worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. He doesn't avoid speaking the truth for fear of being offensive. I'm sure he didn't say it in an offensive way, but he told her the truth about true worship. The Samaritan system of worship was a corruption that led to a false worship. They recognized only the Pentateuch as scripture, as we said, and they changed it in places to support their particular worship in Samaria. Salvation's of the Jews. But back to the issue. The hour is coming. And now is when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not about worship here or worship there. It's about true worship anywhere and everywhere. The hour now is, he says, true worshipers. Worship is spirit and truth. Father is seeking such to worship him. What powerful statements. Spirit and truth, not heritage or descent. The Jews were worshiping by ritual and legalism, not in spirit. The Samaritans were not worshiping in truth. They worshiped in ignorance of the scriptures. So he's addressing both the Jews and the Samaritans, saying, the Jews aren't worshiping in spirit, the Samaritans aren't worshiping in truth. God is spirit. True worship does not involve material things. There is no true spirituality attached to objects or ritual. We worship the Lord in song. Steve plays the guitar and we sing, or somebody else. That's not true worship. It's a facilitation to true worship, but true worship takes place in the spirit, in the heart, in the mind, in the being. It's not an external thing. Now, singing is important. I think singing to the Lord, I mean, we're exhorted to in the scriptures. I think it's a fantastic release and giving of ourselves to God. Some people don't feel comfortable singing. They say, well, my voice is too bad, you know, or I don't want other people to hear me, whatever it might be. It doesn't say anything about volume. It's important to sing and to get that out and to worship the Lord actively, I guess, with your body and your voice. But you don't have to sing loudly. It can be quietly to yourself. You can sing and worship the Lord in the shower or, you know, when you're alone in the house. Doesn't have to be limited. You know, certainly worshiping in spirit and truth is not limited to when we come together here. You know, it should be going on anywhere and everywhere all the time. True worship, we can't see it, taste it, touch it, but you can perform it. You can be an example of it. You can be a participant in it. We worship the Lord in truth. We study the Word of God together, think about it, and discuss it. But it's living the Word is the way that we worship the Lord in truth. It's knowing the Word and doing the Word that is worship in truth. And John says, must. Those who worship must worship in spirit and truth. It's the only true worship. Is the worship that's given in spirit and in truth. And if I am worshiping in this way, then I can know that I'm pleasing to the Lord. He's going to bless that. He's going to bless that worship. We're out of time, but if you bear with me, we'll try to go just a little bit further. Verse 25, the woman says to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. She doesn't necessarily accept his answer about the mountains. You know, well, that's your opinion. I got my opinion. But when Messiah comes, they believe Messiah was coming. Then I know Messiah is coming. And John says, who's called Christ? That's John's interjection. When he comes, he'll tell us all things. He'll tell us that Mount Gerizim is the right place to worship. I'm sure of it. But Jesus, well, this is probably a woman's final attempt at deflection, referring to what she believes is a future and final authority. And then Jesus, of course, says to her, I who speak to you am he. And as you probably realize, the he is added here. It's just, I who speak to you am. Or the order of the Greek words is, I am is speaking to you. And those words are ego, I-me. Ego, which is where we get the word ego from, E-G-O, I, and I-me, am. And this is the name, of course, that Moses gave to, or that God gave to Moses at the burning bush when he says, who shall I say sent me? And the Lord told him, tell them that I am sent you. And so Jesus, and then when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, ego eimi was the words that were used in all those places where God said, I am in the Old Testament. And so we see Jesus claiming that identity for himself. Not just the Messiah in the sense that this is a king who's coming, an earthly king or a deliverer or something of that sort, but I am is speaking to you. I am the I am, he says to her. So at this point, his disciples came and they marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no one said, what do you seek or why are you talking with her? Somebody quoted and said, it's been well said, the disciples marvel that he talks with the woman. They would have been better employed wondering that he talked with them. And, of course, they're just like us. They're just like. And then it says, the woman left her water pot, went into the city, and said to the men, come see a man who told me all things that I ever did. Could this be the Christ? Or is this not the Christ? And then they went out of the city and came to him. So she leaves her water pot there. She's completely abandoned her purpose for coming to the well. She's forgotten all about getting water for her needs. Her need for physical water has paled in comparison to the offer of living water that Jesus has given her. There's a poem that says, I tried the broken cisterns, Lord, but ah, the waters failed. Even as I stooped to drink, they fled and mocked me as I wailed. Now none but Christ can satisfy, none other name for me. There's love and life and lasting joy, Lord Jesus, found in thee. And J. Hudson Taylor said, some are jealous to be successors of the apostles. I would rather be a successor of the Samaritan woman who, while they went for food, forgot her water pot in her zeal for souls. So she goes and she says she went into the city and said to the men. She speaks to the men because the men will listen to her. The women will listen to the men. And so they see a change in her and they want to know more about this man. And so they will come out of the city and they'll come to him. We'll stop here and we'll pick up the next part of this chapter the next time.